television series Joan of Arcadia, but he's also gotten himself a new role. And the great new role is as chairperson of the National Salute to Hospitalized Veterans. This worthy organization, sponsored by the Department of Veterans Affairs, helps focus public attention on VA medical centers and encourages citizens to become volunteers. Joe will be participating in Sunday night's performance, as will Charlie Durning, my fellow World War II vet, who has been coming to these concerts almost as long as I have. If you do come to the West Lawn of the Capitol this Sunday evening, or join with us electronically by watching PBS, you will be treated to the acclaimed National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Maestro Eric Kunzel. Also sharing this splendid and glorious musical gifts with us, are many award-winning artists. The violin virtuoso Joshua Bell, the gifted Alison Krauss and Union Station, featuring Jerry Douglas, and one of the most popular new artists in country music today, Brad Paisley. From the Broadway stage, we are privileged to have the great singer, star actor, Brian Stokes Mitchell, and his co-star of Kiss Me, Kate, and Ragtime, Miss Maren Mazzie. Our participating artists of the spoken word are no less illustrious. It would be our privilege to welcome Mr. Tom Hanks to our stage on Sunday night, who, as you know, is one of the major supporters of the National World War II Memorial. It is fitting that he will be telling the story of D-Day, whose 60th anniversary will be commemorated next week. We'll also honor Charles Durning. Since he keeps coming back, we have to do something to make him feel at home. Who, as a young Ranger, Army Ranger, faced his baptism of fire on the first wave of Omaha Beach and will be sharing his own personal experiences on that longest day. Joe Mantegna will be participating with his young and talented co-star of Joan of Arcadia, Jason Ritter. You may know Jason's lineage from his paternal side. His much-loved and missed father, John Ritter, and his grandfather, the famed singing cowboy Tex Ritter. We've recently found out that his maternal side includes a great uncle, John Red Morgan, whose bravery in World War II was rewarded with the Congressional Medal of Honor. The experiences of the past give us a perspective and understanding to what we are going through today. The show this year bridges two generations reaching out to each other in caring and support. At Sunday's concert, we will pay tribute to those servicemen and women now fighting in Iraq. And we will honor all the World War II vets for their sacrifices of 60 years ago, with a special welcome to all those who have come to town for the dedication of the World War II Memorial. 60 years ago, a lifetime ago, but sometimes it seems like yesterday. World War II was a global conflict, but every soldier who served, it was a very personal struggle for, a personal commitment to duty and service. I was one of those soldiers, and World War II was for me up close and personal. It began in 1935 when Mussolini evicted Haile Selassie from his throne in Ethiopia. I was a boy in high school, and with a friend of mine, we besought our teacher's advice. How could we get to Ethiopia to join in the struggles of the people against Mussolini? But nobody in the class, including the teacher, seemed to know exactly where Ethiopia was. We missed our great opportunity to go and participate in the struggle in 1935. The emperor was somebody that the African-American community cared very deeply about. And we began to watch with great interest what was taking place in Europe and the rise of Hitler and his treatment of the Jews. And so it was that we began to understand that the plans of the evildoers had a special place for us. And I thought that it was my duty to defend myself, my people, and my country against that evil. So after Pearl Harbor, I didn't wait for the draft board to get me. I asked for a small deferment to go south from Harlem, visit my parents, and I would join up at Fort Benning, Georgia. So I volunteered for World War II, knowing that this was a way to fight against this evil, which was pointed, in my opinion, directly at me and my people. I was in the Medical Corps. I had the privilege of serving in Liberia, West Africa, helping to establish the first black station hospital authorized by the Army. And I was happy to be involved. Yet at the same time, there was racism in my own unit and the way we were treated by the Army. But the main goal, the defeat of Hitler and the Nazis, was so clear and so burning that we were prepared to swallow the indignities imposed upon us even by our own army in order to participate in the fight. I was in Liberia at the time of 1944 when D-Day came. And I knew in my heart, with the landing at Normandy, that Hitler was a goner. I didn't know how long it would take, but I knew that we had won, and that one of these days, him and his threat and all his people would be eliminated from the scene. I was sent back home in early 1944 and found that they still wanted me to go to the Pacific Theater, and I had an objection to that. My dedication was personal. I really hasn't joined to fight anybody but the Nazis and the Europeans who were still the colonial masters of Africa. As a matter of fact, though I had no sympathy for the Japanese, I appreciated the fact that they had kicked the French out of Indonesia. So I really wasn't geared up to go and attack Japan. While it was being decided, I was stationed at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, and there the treatment of my country for me and my people was not at all cordial, not the kind I would expect from somebody like me who had gone, I thought, and done heroic duties. So I wasn't a very happy camper. And then, I think it was in April of 45, the bad news that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had died. And I remember being out on a hill with a single tree sitting on it, glad that nobody dared come near me. I don't know. I felt abandoned. I felt that something had changed, that something had gone from the world that was precious, something that I needed that wasn't there anymore. And then later in August of 1945, we dropped the atomic bomb on Japan. And for me, that morally tore me apart. I ceased to exist as a cogent human being. I was a soldier, I guess, for the rest of the time that I was there. I vaguely remember doing my duties. I did ingest a lot of alcohol. And there came a time when I was up on charges for joining a group of soldiers, taking a half track, going around the camp, threatening somebody. I don't know who it was, but I was up on charges. It so happens that the chance to give me an honorable discharge came along in October, So the Army didn't want to waste time trying me. It just gave me an honorable way to get out. But I did get out in October. I immediately got involved in theater. I met a beautiful young lady named Ruby Dee. We became participants of a cross-country tour. And as I went along as an actor, though I was professional and responsible, every chance I got, I would drink. I secretly had a plan to punish America for the way I thought America had punished me. What I was going to do was to just drink myself to death, and everybody would look at me and not understand my sorrow and my passion, and I would feel, you see what you've done to me? You see what you've made me become? A drunkard. That's what you've done to me, America. So I drank to create the situation. Of course, a drunk, whatever his motives, is soon a nuisance and a bother. And I did like Ruby, and she did like me. So on one occasion, she told me, as I tried to explain what I was drinking for, and she said, well, I don't know. I thought you were drinking because of self-pity. You were feeling sorry for yourself. And the truth is, if you feel sorry for yourself, go ahead and drink. But don't blame those fellas, you know, who died overseas and you're drinking because you're sorry for every one of those. Just go ahead and be a drunk and forget it. I took her advice and decided that I'd had enough of suffering. So that's the way I got disabused of my commitment to World War II. Still in all, it was a magnificent human adventure, and I am proud to have served with all the troops who did serve, some giving their lives for their country and for a cause that's dear to us all. And it brings me again, and I appreciate your chance to express our feeling, myself personally, and those of us involved in the concert, and those of us who were in the service, still are, and this group sitting at this particular table over here who paid particular dues for the contributions that they have made. We thank you. We thank everybody that you listen so patiently to our story. Time changes many things, but not the sacrifice and pain of war. Each soldier from America's wars has a deeply personal story to tell. Their memories are the best tribute to their sacrifices and to those of their fallen buddies. In past concerts, we have told some of these stories and those of their loved ones. They continue to echo down to us through the years with their eternal truths. These powerful stories tell the same experiences that Americans are going through today. Because they are so relevant to us, we'd like to share some of them with you right now. In the uncertainty of the first Gulf War, an anxious father wrote a poignant letter to his son. Here to read that letter, with your kind permission, please welcome back our dear friend, Charles Durning.
Knowing Ossie Davis is a revelation. He's smart, kind, loyal, and smart pisses me off. I would like to read something that was written by a father to his son. In January 10th, 1991. Dear Will, yesterday the meeting between Baker and Hassis came to nothing, and the war suddenly became probable. Now I feel I must trace and race against time and try to tell you how much I love you. This is a letter I hoped never to write. I have not been an ideal father. And to this day, and for all the days that are left to me, I will remember you as a small boy asking me to stay home with you and me not being able to grant your wishes. A child's love for a parent seems to endure no matter what. But I wish more than anything that you and your sister should never have any occasion to have to forgive me. Will, you've grown up straight, tall, handsome, smart, and charming. I'm impressed not only with your worldliness, but also your plain values of courage and truthfulness. No family has ever sent into the world a more decent young man and one more loved. Your mother and I are humbled by the magnitude of the sacrifice you are prepared to make. Even now, the pettiness and meanness and the shallowness of life are cast away when we think of you and the light you could always shine on us. We will never, ever be relieved of our sorrow if you are lost to us. If and when that day comes, remember that we are not so interested in glory and honor as much as the decency and compassion and love you show for others near you. Having chosen to risk so much for a cause you feel is just, I know you will always seek justice. If you leave us, depend on us seeking it in your name. My thoughts are with you now and always. Love from your father.
At Sunday's concert, we will honor the 927 courageous men and women who have died in Iraq and Afghanistan. We will also honor the war's hidden casualties, the wounded and disabled. When we hear that soldiers have been wounded, we want to believe that they will quickly heal and go on with their lives. But sadly, this is not always the case. From all of America's wars, almost 2.5 million veterans have returned home disabled. And in this last year, more than 4,000 have been wounded in Iraq. In Iraq, there are no traditional battlefields, only the ever-present possibility of guerrilla attacks and ambushes. The Army's new high-tech armor helps protect the soldiers' vital body parts from the rocket-propelled grenades and homemade bombs. But the extremities remain exposed, and a wounded soldier can bleed to death in 30 minutes. With the sophisticated medical support now available in the field and rapid evacuation to hospitals, there are fewer combat deaths. But ironically, it can be those with the most devastating wounds who survive. There can be severe brain damage, blindness. 3/4 of the wounded have injuries to their limbs, including amputations. Our soldiers in Vietnam faced a similar kind of guerrilla warfare, so the Vietnam vets have a special understanding and empathy to today's young wounded. There's one of these vets here with us today, Jim Meyer, the milkshake man. Many of you may have heard about the milkshake man who volunteers at Walter Reed and Bethesda and brings the wounded milkshakes along with his friendship and support. Jim's story of reaching out will be highlighted at Sunday's concert, and we're happy to welcome him here today. Jim? While disabled vets like Jim Meyer, life back home has called for as much bravery as going into combat. In a past concert, another wounded soldier's words were shared that illuminates some of the emotions that a wounded soldier goes through today. to share the words of Marine Lance Corporal Rick Eilert. Please welcome again our distinguished friend, Joe Mantegna.
Before I read Rick's words, it would be a disservice not to say that this is my third year of doing this concert and my third year of spending this much time with Ossie Davis and Charles Durning. And I come away with it in an election year thinking that come November, one could do a lot worse than writing down the names of Ossie Davis and Charles Durning as my choices for President and Vice President of the United States. You guys don't need a job from me. I knew it was too late. My mind said, run, duck, evaporate. But my body wouldn't react fast enough. I felt a rush go through my body as the grenade exploded. Flames spewed into my face, and then came the smell of burned gunpowder and burning flesh. The pain was so terrible I could hardly breathe, let alone scream. I looked down and saw my leg as it really was. There was no flesh, only torn up muscle, exposed bones and blood. The pain became excruciating. I prayed to God to let me pass out. Come on, Lord, help me out. Why do I have to be the one with a shattered body? I haven't committed any real sins in my life. Why am I being punished now? In the hospital, I was shocked by the lost, frightened expressions on the faces of those whose young minds and bodies had been torn apart. Suddenly, I felt as if I joined a very small fraternity for which my wounds were the initiation. But it was one hell of a lousy fraternity to belong to. My new fraternity brother, Smitty, told me, well, when you're well enough for a wheelchair, you go out by the elevators. You can see the VA hospital from there. That's where they house all the old guys from the big wars. Can you imagine suffering all those years and ain't nobody gives a damn? It wasn't just a question if my wounds would heal, but rather how the people back home would react to me. 7 months earlier, Cheryl and I had been inseparable, madly, passionately in love. Now when I looked in her eyes, I could see she was heartbroken to see me so helpless and smashed up. Cheryl loved me deeply, but now the ugliness of war was there for her to touch, and it frightened her. What right did I have to expect her to want to spend her life with a cripple? My father kept vigil over me. He'd endured World War II so that his son would never have to be put through all the suffering such insanity produced. Yet, there he was, next to his son's twisted, torn body. Almost all of the horribly wounded and deformed patients believed that they would fully recover, at least in the early stages of their hospitalization. Like my buddy Al, whose face was covered in bandages. But once the bandages were off his face, what we saw was horrible. His face was so badly burned, most of his nose was gone, and just a shriveled up eye in one socket and a dark void in the other. Yet Al really believed that his injuries would heal, like all the wounds portrayed on TV and in the movies. But all this pain and terror was real and forever. Just think of it. Forever.
This weekend in Washington, we're privileged to host one of the largest gatherings of World War II veterans ever. During this great reunion, we will, all vets, including myself, be sharing stories of our war experiences. But now I want to share with you the memories of another soldier who fought in the Battle of the Bulge. The Battle of the Bulge was the single biggest and bloodiest battle in our entire nation's history. And ironically, it occurred just when the end of the war seemed in sight. Our sacrifices were devastating. 47,000 were wounded, 23,000 missing and presumed captured, and over 20,000 soldiers were killed, over 80,000 casualties in all. In the Battle of the Bulge, every GI tried to put aside his fears and face the enemy. These are the memories of one of those brave soldiers, infantryman George Karambelis. It was Christmas night, December 25th, 1944, but the snow was not one of nature's beautiful decorations. It was just as deadly as the German machine guns and tanks. Some of that night's events are only lazy recollections, but other memories are still very vivid, especially the premonitions I had of the impending tragedy. First, I kept stumbling for no apparent reason. I even dropped my rifle, which I'd never done before. Then I got tangled up in a few strands of barbed wire and nearly lost my helmet. When we got to the top of the hill, it was very quiet, like when the scout in the cowboy Indian movies say, "Yeah, it's too quiet." Our orders were to go through the woods, firing and screaming in order to demoralize the Germans. But all of a sudden, they began to return our fire with a machine gun. I fired a grenade, saw it hit, and was certain I had knocked the machine gun nest out. But as I turned to crawl back, I felt something crash into my left thigh. It was like I'd been struck with a baseball bat. The medic crawled up to me, checked me out, and applied a dressing. As he started to leave, there was a blinding flash and a deafening explosion that seemed right next to us. I felt a sharp pain on my right foot. The medic groaned and fell over me. I'll help you, I said. But he was already dead. The shrapnel from the German tank had almost cut him in half. And then I heard screams all around. Some of the men were calling for a medic, while others were just crying. I remember two in particular, one who was screaming that he couldn't move, and another who kept moaning, "I'm dying, I'm dying." I started to crawl toward the voices when another explosion knocked me unconscious. I don't know how long I was out, but when I came to, I thought I was dead. What had been pitch dark was now fairly bright, with fires burning and flares going off. My first thought was that I was in hell. I slowly regained my senses, but when I started to move, I realized my legs had been smashed. I tried to sit up just as another shell came in, and I fell flat again. This time I was very frightened because a small fragment hit me above the eye, and suddenly I couldn't see. I thought I was blind, but when I wiped the blood away, I could see. I looked down at my legs. My right foot felt like it was on hot coals. Time had lost all meaning, and I had no idea how long this whole thing had taken. I tried to get up, hoping against hope that somehow I could walk, but it was hopeless. I crawled over to the other men. Their legs were shattered so completely that the slightest movement was impossible. Compared to the others, I was in fairly good shape, and I would have to try to get back and send help. The next few minutes were the most heart-rending moments I have ever known. I'm sure that all the wounded doubted that I'd ever get back and knew that even if I did, help for them wouldn't arrive in time. They gave me messages for their wives, sweethearts, and families. Two of the men had babies whom they'd never seen. And these last farewells to their loved ones made me break down. After reassuring them I'd have help back in time, I started crawling to the edge of the road. The Germans started firing again, but nothing seemed to matter except finding friendly troops, because I knew that before too long I would pass out and freeze to death. Finally, I heard someone walking toward me on the road. I was scared that there might be Germans and that they would finish me off. I took a grenade from my pocket, pulled the pin, and called out, "What company are you guys from?" "A Company, 3rd Platoon," one answered. I replaced the pin and pleaded with them to take me with them. I knew what a burden I was to these two soldiers, but they made a seat with a jacket and their rifles and carried me to the first aid station. As for the men on the hill, I never saw them again. I heard later that none of them made it. May God bless them all. This past year, everyone in our nation has suffered along with our brave soldiers fighting in Iraq. We've all shared the cost of war. These servicemen and women are our sons and daughters, loved ones and friends. We know their families worry every day about their safety. The only way we can truly reach out to them is to first listen to them. By acknowledging their pain and helping to keep the memory of their loved ones alive, we can begin to create a community of caring, of healing. We hope you will be a part of that community. Thank you oh so much for your attention. And see you at the concert Sunday, 8 p.m. on PBS. Thank you again.
The guest speaker today at the National Press Club is actor and director Ozzie Davis. It's now time for audience questions.
Thank you so much. We have several questions for you. The first one is, what can everyday Americans do for disabled veterans?
There are particular things, and there are general things that can be done. I think the particular thing is almost up close and personal. A disabled veteran is still a human being, still a person, but he needs his pass, his acceptance pass, validated one more time. Americans love winners, not losers. Americans love people who are on the go. Americans love things that have no pain and no aftermath. So when we are excluded or forced out by circumstances, you know, and we come back to get in the swim, we're not sure how we would be welcomed if we came back. We need to let the veterans know when they come back to the swim that it's still a public pool and they're still members, that we still love them, and they should be fully qualified to participate. One more time, you've paid extra dues, so the doors open wider, but come on in. You belong to us. You're a part of us. But the general thing about disabled veterans is that ultimately, as human beings, we've got to find a way beyond war itself to resolve the problems we face on the earth. We've got to come up with solutions where veterans will not be created because armies, as we know them now, will not be needed. One of the things I understood as I sat beneath that tree when I heard that the atom bomb was dropped, I understood that that was the end of war as we knew it. And no matter how long it takes us and our country to realize it, we have created the technology that makes war one giant effort in stupidity. One day we'll have to recognize it, and we are the ones who created the choice. So, a world without the need for soldiers will create a world where veterans will no longer be necessary, a world where all can live in peace and equity and harmony. We have to reach out for that world even as we practice the one that we live in, the smaller victories. Thank you.
What would you say was the most stellar moment of your acting career, and what director did you most enjoy working with, and why?
What was the most stellar moment of my acting career, and what director did I most enjoy working with? The most stellar moment of my acting career took place in a play that I wrote called Pearly Victorious, and in which I starred. And there I was on stage every night saying the words that I had written. And being a Baptist, boy, I'm long-winded, you know. But a sentence, I don't write a sentence, I write a page. And then to be permitted to say that on stage. But the most satisfying performance was playing Pearly Victorious, my own play, on stage. And the director I most enjoyed working with was the director who directed me in Pearly Victorious. He was a friend, and his name was Howard De Silva. And he wanted so desperately for me to be an actor, and I didn't want to be an actor. I wanted to be a writer. But I was acting anyway. So one day, we're rehearsing Pearly Victorious, my play. I'm up on stage with my wife reading my lines. Howard De Silva, the director's in the back of the house watching the rehearsal. And finally, he said, no, 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 no. He ran down the aisle from the back of the theater up on stage and said, I see, that is not the author's intent. Oh, I said, well, what the hell is the author's intent? He proceeded to tell me, and I was a good actor after that.
This next questioner asks, what can you say about the security procedures for the concert this year to reassure those who hope to attend in person?
There's nothing that I can say as an individual or a member of any organization that might be reassuring to those who have doubts or fears as to what might possibly happen at the concert. I deeply believe that the concert will take place. It will take place orderly and on time, just as it has in the past. I can give no guarantees, but I do, without any reservation at all, gladly put myself at the forefront, put myself on the line. And that's about the best vote of confidence I can come up with.
The World War II Memorial is drawing extreme reactions. People either love it or hate it. How about you?
I haven't seen the World War II Memorial. And I'm looking forward to seeing it. But I tell you now, before I get close, I'm turning off my feelings. I'm not expecting that the World War II Memorial will speak to me or say something deep or moving to me. If it has a way of getting beyond my non-committal stance, then it will affect me. It will move me. If it doesn't, it won't. At any rate, I didn't come to Washington to sit in judgment on the memorial. I hope it is worthy of the efforts of those whose sacrifice made it worthy and also of the artists who created it. I can't guarantee that that is the case. I do say that the country felt the necessity to express its appreciation for those who did serve so nobly in World War II, and this is one of the ways they did it. If it doesn't rise to what is expected, I'm very sorry, but I appreciate anything. Sometimes anything at all is better than nothing at all. But I will not go to sit in judgment as a critic as to whether it succeeds aesthetically or not. I will accept it simply for what it is, as a gesture to me for having served my country.
This person also asks you to be a critic, and they ask, how would you grade Hollywood on the portrayal of war on film?
I don't know. I don't know what standards are there by which to make judgments. But I would say, in terms of my memory, that Hollywood, I believe, has tended to glorify war, to glorify America's participation in war, not to give us enough of the blood and bones and truth of the situation. We could almost say that Hollywood has been a part of the propaganda arm of those of us who had military objectives in view. In the time of war, when we needed all of the people to come together and collectively put their shoulders behind the wheel, propaganda might, you know, be the thing that was appropriate to make that happen. But I think all too often Hollywood has made war a little bit too glorious and a little bit too non-bloody and a little bit not true and not real. The wars that we have fought in our country have oftentimes been wars of principle, but that's not always been true. We fought wars of destruction. We fought wars of colonization. The things we did when we went into the Philippines are not things that any of us can be proud of. So there are many things that we as Americans, as we expressed our power militarily, did which we should not be proud of. Therefore, I think Hollywood, because it passes off as entertainment, is not often criticized, maybe as much as it should. But of course, it is entertainment, and art has its permission to portray things as it sees them, as it sees fit. I don't know to what degree Hollywood should be required to give us the facts. I would say that Hollywood, if it expresses America's concept of itself, if Hollywood is a part of how America shares that information which a democratic society must have in order to make learned and intelligent decisions, Hollywood has failed us. It could do much better.
And on that note, I'd like to thank you for coming today, Mr. Davis, and I'd like to present to you with this certificate of appreciation to match the others that you have. And to help complete your set, we give you the coveted National Press Club mug.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One last question. And our last question to you is, you and Ruby Dee have been married about 56 years?
Yes.
What is your secret to a long and happy marriage?
Well, of course, the obvious answer is, of course, the secret is that there is no secret. But maybe some of the things that were important to us, or some of the things that we were fortunate enough to be involved in, were helpful. We, upon being asked this question, have asked ourselves this question. And the answer we usually come up with is that somehow or other, we step into the theater and we stepped into each other's lives at a high moment in the struggle for human dignity in which a lot of people were engaged. And it was almost as if we joined the army and bonded as two soldiers will bond and guaranteed that we would protect each other's backs as we joined the march, trying to achieve certain states of affairs from our government, from our society that related to justice for African Americans and for others. And that the struggle always required of us a little bit more than we had to offer. The struggle kept us so busy, we never had time to sit down and ask, "Are you happy?" We never had time to really wonder whether we were successes or not. I do know when we had children, we were smart enough to take the children into the struggle with us. We marched with the children at our side. We picketed with the children. We rallied. We demonstrated. They were always there. They never had to worry about where Mom and Papa were, what we were doing. They were always involved. And we ourselves were always involved. Think of it, in 1946, meeting each other, stepping into a world where you might meet Paul Robeson on one side of the aisle at a meeting and Marlon Brando on the other, you know, with Orson Welles in the background, making a speech about what shall we do about the atom bomb? Shall we share it with the Russians or not? Or what shall we do about Willie McGee? They're going to electrocute him in Mississippi. Going some night after the theater to raise funds for Rosalie Ingram, whose sons had killed a man who had assaulted her. We were so involved, and there was always something to be done. Some struggle, some leader, some activity requiring our fullest participation. And we think that that participation kept us lean, kept us focused, and gave us gave us connections that were stronger than the ones we read about in the love magazines and see in the motion pictures. Somebody asked me a moment ago something relating to this, whether or not when Ruby's birthday came, or I forget now what we were talking about, whether I had a gift for her. And I explained something. On December 9th, which is the anniversary of our wedding, Ruby and I will go and buy the biggest poinsettia we can find and bring it home. And that is our gift to each other for the whole year. I don't have to give her something for Christmas. She doesn't have to give me anything for Father's Day. We don't bother with Mother's Day and all the other days that the merchants have focused on you. They pass us by. All we have to do is to buy that flower, and that satisfies our needs. So we've sort of learned, you know, that there is in each of us, as I see her and she sees me, We sort of learn that there is something that we hang on to. Let me tell you a little fable that is true, more true than maybe that it should be, and then I'll be through. Do I have a minute to tell you a little fable? All right. Well, we were working together unmarried in this tour, and we were both in Los Angeles in the play. Ruby came to me and said, "Ossie, let's go back to New York. There's a black producer. He's going to produce a show, and it's called The Fight Never Ends. It's going to star Joe Louis. They want me to be in it, but if you go with me, I'll get you a job in it too." And so she wanted me to go. I said, "No, Ruby, I got this job here, and I like this job. It pays every week, and you know I'm saving my money so I can go to Columbia to study playwriting. So every week when they pay me, I put my money in that little handkerchief I got right here, and I had quite a nice bosom of money right there. So I'm going to stay and work on my money." So she left and went to New York and joined the filmmaking crew. I stayed. When the film was over, we went all the way back to New York from Seattle to Grand Central, 5 days. Ruby was already there. We got out of the train, came up, and there was Ruby standing at the head of the stairs. And this was one of the most fantastically beautiful women I had ever seen in my whole life. And of course, I was always in love with her, and she, you know, but that day, something special. I said, "Oh, Ruby, how marvelous of you to come to see us." "That I didn't come to see everybody, I came to see you." I said, "I'm glad, oh, I'm so happy. How is the film?" She said, "Oh, Ossie, I'm so glad you asked. The film is finished." I said, "It is." She said, "Yes, it's in the lab. All we need is some money to get it out, and we'll distribute it." "And we'll distribute it, and then everything will be all right." I said, "You need money to get the film out?" She said, "Yes, yes, we need money." I said, "How much do you need?" She said, "Well, shall we step into this little coffee shop?" We stepped into the coffee shop. "How much do you need?" And she knew that I had been saving my money. You know, I said, "Well, Ruby, I've saved my money for my matriculation, but here it is in July, and school doesn't open until September. I've got a little money here." I said, "How much do you need?" She said, "Well, how much have you got?" And I said, "I got about $3,000. That's exactly what we need." So she persuaded me to lend her and the production to $3,000, and on the basis that it would get it out, put it into distribution. First money's come back to me. I could go to Columbia in the fall. Well, I gave her the money. I went about my business matriculating. She went about business finishing the film. I lived at that time in the Bronx. And as I said before, this was before we were married. One day, knocks on the door, or I opened the door, and there in front of me was Ruby Dee looking up at me with the saddest eyes I'd ever seen in a woman's face. I said, "Ruby, what's the matter?" She said, "May I come in?" I said, "Oh, yes, please do come in. Come in, sit down." She said, "No, maybe you had better sit down."